Assalamu alaikum. Good evening. When Liz initially asked me to speak about gender, race, Islam, and the war on terror, I have to say I wasn't overly enthused because that's not my primary area in which I write. I'm primarily interested in how Muslims read the Quran and in how they produce religious, you know, the production of religious meaning in Islam. That's really my primary area of interest has been for some few years. But I've cobbled together something based on previous talks and a couple of articles, and so I'd like to share that with you. And I think for me, a starting point for a workshop like this is to interrogate the notion of a war on terror, because we throw around the term quite loosely, and of course you probably know by now, you know, all of the stuff about how you can't have a war on terror. I mean, terror is not a human being, it's not a person, it's not a country, it's not a geographic entity, so there is that critique of the war on terror. For me, it's also interesting to get into an interrogation of what we mean by terror. And I've been reading different definitions, including one that's offered by the US State Department. And I can't quote it verbatim, but it's something to the effect that it's these are acts of violence against civilian populations that are meant to produce some kind of spectacle or spectacular effect. And I think if we use that definition, then certainly the United States of America can be accused of being a terrorist. And when I said this to Richard Bremer, who subsequently became the ambassador against terrorism in Iraq, I said this to him actually several years ago when I was still a graduate student. Needless to say, I got a death stare, and for the rest of the workshop, I was studiously ignored. But the fact is that states today target civilian populations, not just, you know, accidentally, they're not just collateral damage, but very much as a strategy of war. And I think they do so in order to produce spectacle and spectacular results. And so for me, it becomes really extremely problematic to throw around this term very loosely. My own take on this has been, like many other people, I'm not unique in arguing, that whoever the West, and I use the term somewhat hesitantly because the West isn't a monolithic entity, the United States isn't a monolithic entity, but people who like to think of themselves as Westerners, people who like to use the term the West, I take them seriously, and I say if that's your self-definition, then certainly the West, and specifically the Bush administration, has chosen to define all of those Muslims who do not agree with Washington's policies as terrorists. Now, a couple of years ago, there was an interview published in the local newspaper of a young soldier, 21 years old, who had returned from service in Afghanistan, and he talked to a reporter, and, you know, that interview was published in the Ithaca Journal. One of the things he said is that US soldiers in Afghanistan were told that there is no such thing as a non-combatant. Even if you see women and children, you operate from the assumption that they are possibly combatants and you shoot them. And so when this was published, there was a bit of an outrage, and then of course he had to come back and then to try and modify what he had said earlier. But the fact of the matter is that in its war on terror, the United States has actually directed its soldiers not to differentiate between civilian and military targets. And while this has been happening abroad, at home, those of you who follow politics know that there has been a severe rollback in the civil liberties of Muslims in the United States of America. There's a whole host of measures that are now justified under the Patriot Act, which have legalized racial profiling, surveillance, preemptive arrests and detentions, secret courts, and the denial of legal rights, not only to those people who have been accused of terrorism, but to those people who are suspected of harboring an intent to harm the United States of America. I don't know how many lawyers there are in this audience, and I am not even sure how you go about quantifying that suspicion. There have been debates in the US that they should change citizenship laws so that anybody accused of, again, a suspicion of terrorism, can, if they're born a citizen, they can, you know, have their citizenship taken away. But they do want to change the citizenship rules. And one state has even debated mandating a 25-year sentence in prison, not just for terrorists, but for people who take part in anti-war protests. Okay, so much for the war on terror. The things that interest me about this war, there are a couple of things. One is the role of the United States, which calls itself a secular country, and it's become complicit in defining religious practices. In particular, the Bush administration's tendency to distinguish between what it calls militant Islam and moderate Islam sets the framework for the states to become involved in religious matters. And my own sense is that these references to a militant Islam and a moderate Islam, a peaceful Islam and a violent Islam, an Islam that is the US's mortal foe and an Islam that is its trusted friend, suggest that in the end the problem lies with the schizophrenic Islam itself. The problem of violence is not even partly of the US's making, because all the onus is shifted onto these two Islams. And this official view of Islam as a pair of good and evil twins conjoined at the hip, I think, performs two crucial political functions. On the one hand, by portraying militant Islam as the real threat to global security, Washington is able to deflect any critiques of US foreign policy, because these days every single problem is seen to be associated with radical Islam. On the other hand, by shifting the burden of defeating and eradicating militant Islam onto moderate Islam, the US again absolves itself of any responsibility to rethink its own policies. Now, I said earlier that the secular state has become complicit in defining religion. To me, that is really bad news, because historically the claim of secularism has been that it does not interfere in religious matters, that the state stays neutral, and it actually provides some kind of a protective environment, if you will, for different groups to practice their religions. But by labeling some readings and practices of Islam as being militant and others as moderate, solely on the basis of how well they fit into George Bush's agendas or the US's perceived national interests, the administration has legalized and legitimized the US, the use of religion as an instrument of state policy. And maybe that doesn't surprise many people here, but that's the reason why so many people in the US criticize countries like Saudi Arabia and Iran, because they say the state has, you know, become active in defining religion. But what is the United States doing then? Now, the consequence of this for Muslims like myself is that the arena within which we are able to practice our religion in the future will increasingly come under state surveillance and control. In fact, by punishing some practices and rewarding others, public policy will also impact how Muslims even think about Islam. And that is why the attempt to control public practices impinges also on private convictions, inasmuch as public practices are never independent of privately held beliefs. Now, another consequence of the US administration's, I call it a self-serving and instrumentalist approach to Islam, is to weaken the secular underpinnings of the US state, just as its assault on civil liberties will undermine the state's putatively liberal character. So, what's going around is going to come around. In their attempts to manage and demobilize certain groups of Muslims, the way that this administration is going about it, and I assume if the Canadians follow that, that would be true of this country as well, that you're going to weaken the democratic and secular underpinnings of your own state. obviously most people don't think that far ahead because it's like, as long as you keep me safe from the Muslims, that's all that matters. So many US Americans, when they have been polled about, are you, you know, would you support curtailing the civil liberties of Muslims, have said yes, they would. But what's interesting is that once you put those laws on the books, then, you know, there is no saying that those laws will stop just as Muslims. Now, what is at stake, I think, in Washington's attempts to promote a moderate Islam is not only the relationship of Muslims to Islam, but, as I said, the very secular and democratic nature of the state. Now, that's, you know, part of what I wanted to speak about, because the war on terror makes no sense to me, and in attempting to put its different pieces together, the best I can offer you are little snippets. That was so far as the state is concerned, that is so far as definition of terrorism is concerned. A second thing that interests me is the representation of Muslims. Because even as US Americans, and in particular the Bush administration, seeks to distinguish moderate from militant Muslims and moderate from militant Islam, there is still a tendency to put all Muslims into the same category, you know? And here I was reading a book by Albert Memmi, who was a Tunisian Jew, and he wrote on colonialism, as some of you probably know, or many of you know. And I was very struck by the manner in which Memmi speaks about the attitude of the colonizers to the colonized. And what he says is that the colonized are always branded with the mark of the plural. And he gives an actual example of this. He says, the colonized is never characterized in an individual manner. He, and let's forgive the sexist language for a moment, he is entitled only to drown in an anonymous collectivity. They are this. They are all the same. If a colonized servant does not come in one morning, the colonizer will not say that she is ill, or that she is cheating, or that she is tempted not to abide by an oppressive contract. He will say instead, you can't count on them. So he refuses to consider personal, private occurrences in his bait's life. That life, in a specific sense, does not interest him, and his maid does not exist as an individual. I think you could apply this whole paragraph to Muslims in the United States today. That Muslims also are branded with the mark of the plural, that we do not exist as single individuals. We exist only as representations of this dreaded, dreadful other. And like other minorities, we carry the burden of representation. A last factor that I want to speak about, and this whole stage seems to be gradually moving beneath me, so I may land up in your laps. A third factor that I want to speak about is gender, and in particular the use of women to demarcate all sorts of boundaries between moderates and militants, between Islam and the West, between terrorists and non-terrorists. And I've always been fascinated, as a Muslim woman, I've always been fascinated by the perception of me as part of this exotic other. Now, I want to say at the outset that what I'm going to say here doesn't necessarily mean that I condone, you know, when sometimes you speak on behalf of Muslims, immediately the allegation is leveled at you that you condone oppression. As a matter of fact, in my own work, I seek to contest the oppression of Muslim women, and I do this primarily by looking at the way in which sacred knowledge is used to oppress them. So I am very much aware that the representation of Muslim women as oppressed is all just a figment of the imagination. Muslim women are oppressed. Many Muslim women are oppressed. I see that as a reality, and I certainly don't blind myself to that fact when I say what I do. But it seems to me sometimes that Western feminist crusading is what I call it. This crusade for liberating Muslim women has always troubled me. And I think that part of the reason is because of the way in which many feminists, obviously not all, but I call them imperial feminists, the way in which they think about difference. For them, difference becomes what, actually, let me quote here, Sheila Bulbeck calls the idea of radical difference or hyper-separation. In other words, the absolutizing and magnifying of differences, considering that there's this line between Muslim women and non-Muslim women. And Muslim women are just so radically different from non-Muslim women that they live in this other world, so to speak. And yet the idea that other women are radically different from white Western women, I think, is integral to white Western women's construction of themselves. Many times I am tempted to conclude that the reason feminists even promote certain kinds of discussions about Islam, and I've been chastised for this by the feminists on my own campus, is basically to present themselves in contrast as liberated. So they will, you know, during Islam week, they will show these movies about Muslim women who are terribly oppressed, you know, in My Father's House, that film. And they'll pick all of these little gems to show how, you know, Muslim women have no voice, they're utterly oppressed, they're utterly at the behest of their fathers and brothers and husbands and so on and so forth. And they do this in the name, really, of showing solidarity. But I have always critiqued them, and I said, this gives you some kind of, you know, shall we say, visceral pleasure, because you can pat yourself on the back and go home feeling good about yourself. At least I don't live like that. So, for me, that's problematic because it assumes that sexism, patriarchy, and violence only exist in the Muslim world, and we end up ignoring the high rates of violence against women in these societies. You know, I don't know the latest statistics on rape, but I think it was something like a rape occurs every 14 seconds. And so even as many of these feminists are campaigning for women's rights in Afghanistan, they're ignoring the violence that is being done to women in their own societies. Now, I don't know very much about the role of the Canadian state in the war on terror. And I also don't know how widespread this tendency is to view Muslims as the quintessential others. But I just want to give a brief anecdote. The other day there were two articles in the National Post, one on Freud and the other by Leonard Stern or somebody, basically talking about how for Muslim groups it's always about Israel. And when I read those pieces, I felt irritated and annoyed, and I sat down and I wrote a short letter to the editor, which was published yesterday as the letter of the day. Now, what's interesting is that the majority of my comments were directed at actually the article on Freud, because of the example of mass pathology he cites, not just Al-Qaeda, but anyone who's sympathetic to them. And I think the unstated assumption is that Muslims who do not think in a particular way are necessarily opposed to the West, and that only Muslims oppose the West. And so I try to set that, you know, to dispel that idea. And in one or two lines, I basically referred to Stern's article, saying that perhaps one of the reasons that, you know, it's always about Israel has something to do with the fact that Israel occupies Palestinian territory and oppresses the Palestinian people. And of course, all hell has broken loose because I've been vilified in personal emails, and there are three pieces today, three letters, each one of which is, I think, you know, basically saying because the West doesn't arrest people like her, we're in trouble. So, you know, across the border, we always look over at the Canadians and we think you're so sensible. You have a good relationship to power, which is you don't take it seriously. And anytime, you know, we say, okay, if you want to escape the jingoism of the 4th of July, just cross the border into Toronto and you're, you know, in a safe space. But when I see things like that, I'm deeply discouraged. And I don't know whether there is, in fact, an anti-war movement in Canada. I don't know how strong it is. I don't know how persistent it's been. Those are things I will be educated about in the next 2 days. But I want to end with a longish quotation from Memmi, and I ask your indulgence for this. I won't draw out any, you know, I won't editorialize about it. I just want to read it to you. And the point of departure for that is exactly my question. What are Canadian citizens doing today to speak out against, you know, the politics of oppression by, that their own government might be engaging in vis-a-vis Muslims? This is Memmi. It is true that the citizens of free countries tell themselves that they have no voice in the nation's affairs, that their actions are useless, that their voice is not heard, and that the elections are fixed. Such people claim that the press and radio are in the hands of a few, that they cannot prevent war or demand peace, or even obtain from their elected representatives that for which they were sent to Parliament. However, they at least immediately recognize that they possess the right to do so, the potential, if not the effective power, that they are deceived or weary but not enslaved. They try to believe they are free men, and I assume women, momentarily vanquished by hoaxes or stunned by demagoguery. Driven beyond the boiling point, they are seized by a sudden anger, break their paper chains, and upset the politicians' little calculations. Thinking it over, they may feel guilty for not having revolted more often. After all, they are responsible for their own freedom. And if, because of fatigue or weakness or skepticism, they do not use it, they deserve their punishment. Thank you.